Then I started to think about China, and I thought about the modern day Inquisition, and I wanted to get that's happening against the Muslims there in China, where they have these camps where they have like 2 million innocent human beings.
Oh, if it's not Noah's Ark, it's somebody's Ark. And what's it doing up there?
Well, it's not because I question it, it's because I challenge it.
Did the Muslims pay you?
Pardon?
Did the Muslims pay you?
I go to the sources themselves. The people I'm criticizing, I go to their books, to their documents, to their records, I get their statements. And most of them talk quite frankly about it. And she said, you know, I'm part of the team that was working with your biography. She said, are you aware that you're the center of a big controversy among the editors at Wikipedia? I said, who, me?
This is the Dean Show.
How are you doing, Mr. Griffin?
Well, I'm doing well.
So you're a author, filmmaker, and I got turned out to you years ago when I watched a film that I recommend everybody watch. It's called The Truth About Cancer, A Global Quest. And you were in that film. That's a documentary with Ty Bollinger. You remember that?
Yes, I do.
Mm-hmm. You're also known for, in your filmmaking industry, I believe it was called A World Without Cancer.
Right. I produced that little, very low-budget documentary back in the days when people were using film strips. So that was produced as a film strip. Mm-hmm. Then later we digitized it, and it's now played as though it's video, but nothing moves in it. It's just a bunch of still pictures with the narration behind it.
So tell us, what else did I miss? Tell us anything else you'd like to share with our audience about yourself.
Well, no, nothing. If you're talking about the books I've written, I guess the one that's had the biggest play is The Creature from Jekyll Island, A Second Look at the Federal Reserve.
Before I get into health, cancer, and some of these other things that you like to talk about with your show, I also noticed you talk about a lot about communism and socialism.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
What is it, are these terms you mentioned, can you define these terms and help educate our audience now on are these, when you use them interchangeably, are they just synonymously, are they just the same thing?
They're not exactly the same thing. On the surface, they're quite different. By the way, are we on the show now?
Yes, we are. Yes.
Oh, okay. Well, I thought we were just leading up to it.
Yeah.
So I have to be more articulate than what I say. I have to slow down and think my thoughts through before I start talking. So yeah, communism, socialism, fascism, Nazism, left wing, right wing, Republican, Democrat. Progressive, liberal, conservative. What do these words mean? They have internal meanings to those of us who use them, but you can pretty well win the bar bet by betting on the fact that nobody else will agree with your definition, because it's highly internalized and there's a lot of emotion involved, pretty much in terms of, well, this is what I believe, and I think I've been called a, let's say I've been called a liberal or a conservative, so I guess I'm a conservative, but this is what I believe. So, and that's internal, and it's different from one person to the next. And to cut to the short chase on this, I found out back in the 1960s when I started to do research on this. I was a young guy climbing the corporate ladder. I didn't care much about ideology or world affairs, but I got intrigued, and that's another story. But I suddenly decided to start checking into some of these deeper topics, and I hung out at the communist bookstore. I went down there to see what they had to say. I was curious, and they tried to recruit me. You know, they got me into study groups, and I was serious. I wasn't serious about becoming a communist, but I wanted to know what these people believed. So I went to the study groups. I bought a lot of their books, and I actually read them. And I found out very quickly that a lot of the guys down there that were, and gals, they talked about these books, but they'd never read them. And so all of a sudden, I found myself as the expert in this group because ask Griffin. He's read, all of the volumes, not all of the volumes of Vladimir Ilyich Lenin. Oh, my God, he's written tens of thousands of pages worth of essays and so forth. But I'd read a lot of them, and I'd read, Karl Marx, the Communist Manifesto and Das Kapital. And then, so I got a pretty good idea what that was all about, and I was curious. I started reading some of the stuff from the Nazis. I read, Mein Kampf, And I read stuff that Mussolini wrote. He didn't write a lot, but it's enough to see it. And then I read Mao Zedong, and then I read Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and I was reading everybody. And to make a long story short, Eddie, we got to the point where I suddenly realized, you know, this is all the same stuff. These people actually believe the same thing, except they oppose each other, of course. They fight wars against each other, the communists versus the Nazis in World War II. What was that about? I thought it was because they were enemies over what they believed in, but no, I found out they believed exactly the same thing. In fact, the Nazi Party is the National Socialist Party. That's what Nazi stands for. It's the abbreviation of National Socialism. A lot of the people who were Nazis went over and became communists. And a lot of the people who were communists went over and became Nazis. They could move back and forth and have virtually no disagreement on anything of principle. The only thing they really disagreed on is who was going to win, who was going to have control over the territory, who was going to be the ruler. You see, it was a question of power and not ideals. And boy, when that hit me, I started to take notes as to what were the essential elements of this thing that they believed in. And I found out that there's a word for it, and it's called collectivism. And all these words, socialism, communism, fascism, blah, 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 are just variants of the word collectivism. Mm-hmm. And the constructive opposite of collectivism is individualism. And I found out, too, that prior to World War II, those words were pretty well known, and people used those words back in the day. I got hold of some of these old books, went back to some of the old newspapers and magazines, and the word collectivism and individualism was a common word, and educated people knew what it meant. But after World War II, the word disappeared, and when I went to school, even through the university, I never heard the words, and I didn't know what they were until I started to discover them in these old books. So, having said all of that, I think it's important, at least for me, it seems very important to recognize that most of the conflict, political conflict out there in the world, including in our own little world, like here in the United States, we fight like the devil to see who's gonna get, you know, control of Congress, the Democrats or the Republicans, or the left wing versus the right wing, the conservatives versus the liberals. And I discovered, heck, both of those groups essentially believe the same thing, and we were fighting over a non-choice. We were given a non-choice. You know, like even today, no point in getting too close to the present, because then you start stepping on people's toes. You're talking about people who are their current heroes. You can talk about the dead guys, but now if you're talking about somebody you voted for in your lifetime, all of a sudden the people's are come to the defense and so forth. But we're basically given a choice in our modern world. What do we want to be, a communist or a Nazi? You know, choose up sides. And wait a minute, and you come to the point where you say, wait, I don't want either one of those, but you don't have a choice. Those are the two sides, and you have to, that's why people today, in politics today, do not vote for a candidate, generally. They don't like anybody, but they vote against somebody. They typically you hear, oh, I really don't like him at all, or her, but I hate the other guy, and so I'm going to vote for the lesser of two evils. And see, that's the game. That's the world game of world politics today. You're always given a choice of what you think is the lesser of two evils, but they're basically the same evil. Mm-hmm. So I come back to the shorthand version of the answer to your question, and that is that I see this left wing, this left-right paradigm, as the analogy would be a left wing and a right wing on the same ugly bird called collectivism. And we've got to get out of this this idea that we have to choose one or the other, because they're essentially the same. Mm-hmm. That's why we lose all the time. That's why this country has continually been moving toward collectivism, toward totalitarianism, control from the top. We lost a country where our leaders were supposed to serve the people. Now it's the people are supposed to serve the leaders, as long as the leaders tell them, it's for your own good. It's mm-hmm. for the greater good of society. It's for the greater good of the greater number. And then we're supposed to say, oh, yeah, okay, we're going to do this, we're going to do that. Give up our freedom, give up our liberty, because it's the greater good. We're going to fight terrorism, or we're going to fight a pandemic, or we're going to fight climate change. We're always going to fight something that's for the greater good, for the greater number of society. But in every step, no matter where you look in any of these crises, the solution that we are given the choice of is we have to give up our liberties and pay more taxes and be more subservient and do what we're told. And that is the trick. If you can see that, then all of these propaganda efforts just disappear because you know exactly what they're trying to do to you.
Before I go into talking to you about the history, a very interesting history that you write about, you talk about, and like I said before, I got turned out to by that documentary, The Truth About Cancer, A Global Quest, but then I saw some of the other things that you've spoken about, so I just want to touch upon that. I heard about you talking about communism, socialism, and how they're all the same. Then I started to think about China, and I thought about the modern day Inquisition, and I wanted to get that's happening against the Muslims there in China, where they have these camps where they have like 2 million innocent human beings. I just wanted to get your thoughts on that. What do you think? You know, that's would China be classified? That's a communist country, is that right?
Oh, absolutely. They're very proud of that. They're self-proclaimed Marxist-Leninists and communists. So it's not the fact that we're calling them a name or something, because that's what they call themselves.
Yeah. Are you familiar with what's going on with the Uyghur, with the Muslim Uyghurs there?
Yes, right? I think I'm fairly familiar. Well, you see, that again is not so unusual, because communism and fascism and any other form of collectivism demands total subservience to the state. So that means there's no room in a collectivist society, no matter what they call themselves, communist, Nazi, or whatever. There's no room in such a society for religion, any religion. It's not just the Muslims or the Christians or the Jews or something. There's no room for religion of any kind, because when you have religion, people have a loyalty to another set of ideals, and they look to their religious leaders, and they look to their holy books and to their spiritual values for solutions to problems. The state does not tolerate that. You're supposed to be completely subservient to the state. The state becomes the god, and you have to worship the state. So, yes, at the moment, the Chinese are persecuting and virtually trying to either brainwash first, get them away from their religious beliefs, or destroy them. And they did the same thing with Christians, and they will do that with any religion. So it's not really a question of which religion it is. We have to understand that any theology of any kind, other than theology that the state is the great God, and we should worship the people, and we're worshiping us, ourselves. You know, they get in that mind-twisting kind of stuff, because they've been told that the state is them. But it's not. It's the rulers, and they're supposed to be content with the idea that, well, they voted for somebody, therefore it must be okay.
Now, when people go, and I'm sure they will, look up your name, for those who aren't familiar with you, it talks about filmmaker, author, but then they threw a word in there that really confuses some people and throws some people off. Do you know what that word is?
Oh, of course, yeah. It's the word they throw at anybody they wanted, or one of the words they throw. Yeah, I'm supposed to be a conspiracy theorist. Wikipedia threw that on me some years ago. By the way, I've never put anything up in Wikipedia about myself. Other people had, and I didn't even know it was up for quite a while. And then, how about that? I'm on Wikipedia. And then one day, somebody said, "Do you know what they're calling you on Wikipedia?" I said, "No, what? A conspiracy theorist." So I looked, and sure enough, that's what it was. Well, anyway, to make a long story short, yeah, I had no control over that. The fact of the matter is, and this is a little side story, one of the editors of Wikipedia, the editors, called me one day, introduced herself, and she said, "You know, I'm part of the team that was working with your biography." She said, "Are you aware that you're the center of a big controversy among the editors at Wikipedia?" I said, "Who, me?" "No." And she said, "Yeah." She says, I'm one of others." She said, "There's a group of us that we read what they said about you, and we thought, well, this guy is, you know, he's terrible. He's a conspiracy theorist. He's got all these incorrect theories, and he's probably a racist and so forth." And she said, "But I started to do some research," and she says, "I read your books," a couple of them. And she said, "No, you're not any of those." I said, "Well, thank you for that. I know I'm not." And she said, "So we objected, and we tried to change the narrative. And from above, she said, I was threatened to shut up or they're going to take me off of my post. And she said, there are some people there at Wikipedia who actually devote their lives to dominate the opinions of the editors. And you don't normally get to be an editor, even if you show any kind of open-mindedness to this sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So I asked her to write a book, and she said someday she will after she retires or something. Well, I can hardly wait. But anyway, so yeah, I understand. And by the way, that the reason in that case why they labeled me as a conspiracy theorist is because not of my political beliefs, but because of my advocacy of alternative medicine or natural-based medicine as opposed to pharmaceutical-based medicine. Because I have learned that the pharmaceutical companies, and this is not just pharmaceutical companies, by the way, all the big corporations of the world, all of them, I think that's a fairly safe thing to say, they have people who are on the payroll who do nothing but monitor any comments that deal with their corporation or the industry in which they're involved. They're actually on the payroll to monitor that so that the minute something comes on that is unfavorable to their reputation or to the acceptance of their product, these guys go in there and they change it because mm-hmm. they're editors now. And of course, they don't get paid by Wikipedia, but they get paid by the corporations, which they're not supposed to be, but it's all sort of under the table. So anybody who criticizes the pharmaceutical industry in any way, or criticize not just the industry, but their products, like anybody who would criticize vaccines today, is immediately, within probably 3 minutes or less, somebody has picked it up, their comment, and they're in their Wikipedia listing, they will become a conspiracy theorist, you see, automatically. And you have no control over it. There's nothing you can do about it, at least at present, because mm-hmm. the Wikipedia has earned the reputation of being the voice of authority and unbiased. It's anything but unbiased, mm-hmm. totally biased. And if you're talking about mathematics or something, maybe you could trust what it says. But anything to do with profit and loss, like an industry and health and politics, or the big issues, money and power, the players who have a large stake in money and power are actually controlling everything about that in Wikipedia and other sources as well.
In there, it also mentions 9/11 truther. Is that because you question the official narrative and story of 9/11?
Well, it's not because I question it, it's because I challenge it. Mm. I mean, I go much further than questioning it. I don't want to pussyfoot around with it. To me, it's totally, totally absurd. I mean, it's like so many things. Once you really open your eyes and start looking objectively, you have no axe to grind. You're not protecting. I don't make any money for taking this position. In fact, it hurts me a lot. I mean, people think I'm crazy and so forth. Why would you want to take a position like that when you don't benefit from it? Just everything goes against you.
Did the Muslims pay you?
Pardon?
Did the Muslims pay you?
Well, no, they don't.
Because they try to blame Islam and Muslims. So, now the truth is coming out and people are being labeled. So they might say, maybe you're on the Muslims' payroll now.
No, I'm not on anybody's payroll. I'm one of those unemployed people called self-employed.
Self-employed, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, that's it. I just wanted to make it clear. People have a lot to lose by doing this. Why do they do it? Well, it's because they can't help it. It's the truth. I mean, we feel some of us just have this crusader gene that starts to vibrate, and we think, but that's not true. That's not right. Now, we could be wrong. I'm the first to recognize that not only could I be wrong, but I probably am wrong on some things. I found out as I get older, and I'm quite old now, that I've changed my position on numerous things that I felt that I was correct on when I was a young man. So I'm not saying that I or anybody in who reads my stuff and likes what I write, I'm not saying that this is not doctrine. It's just that this is what we believe. And if we see something that's wrong and harmful to the human race, if it's going to steal their livelihood, if it's going to make them subservient to the state, turn them into slaves and ruin their health or something like that, we get kind of ticked off by it. And we can't help it. We just say, well, wait a minute, I can challenge that. And of course, then all the big guns are turned on you, and all of a sudden, you know, the bullets are whizzing by, and you're called a conspiracy theorist, a racist, a communist, a Nazi, all this, anything, a cheat, a liar, you know, a murderer. They'll throw anything at you. And unfortunately, a large number of the population will say, gee, I read it in Wikipedia. It must be true.
Mm-hmm. That's really interesting. So I commend you. I mean, many people, they pretty much just follow the mainstream narrative, but you went above and beyond, and you researched, and you know, not just like you said, questioned. You actually started to, speak out, or is there?
Yes. I said, this is what I found. Attention, everybody. Look what I found. You know, this is important. It affects you and your life, your future, your freedom. And, you know, so that's the way I've been ever since I got into this, which was quite by accident. I was already a young guy. I was climbing the corporate ladder. I had no interest in any of these things. And then I just started to have my eyes open.
Yeah, so finishing up on the 9/11, to us, it's also very sensitive because, you know, when that year rolls around, the slogan, never forget. And we became, as Muslims, you know, professional condemners. We're always condemning these acts. You know, Islam doesn't teach it. You know, people might take a fringe element to do something, just like in any religion, and they try to prompt them up as if they're, you know, the ones, the exemplary example of that way of life. But this is what was the catalyst for much of the wars that were perpetuated, you know, the fear and division, and was this event that happened. And now just it's nice to hear people, and then you have so many architects and engineers and others who are coming out, you know, and speaking out like you are. So commend you.
Yes,
for
well, and it's not because we have any axe to grind, believe me. I mean, everybody in the world recognizes that 9/11 was a horrendous event, and but the real question is, yeah, who did it and what were their motives? Now that gets murky, because it means you have to be open-minded to consider some facts that you're not going to like to hear. And if you close your mind the minute you suspect that the fact is unpleasant, well, then you're not very smart, because that means you'll never learn anything. Mm-hmm. Because in order to learn something, usually you have to replace some ideas of knowledge that are not correct. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've done that a lot in my life. I remember back in the early days in the 60s when I caught fire on all this, I was so inflamed with the idea that you have to fight communism. And by the way, I haven't changed my position on that a bit. But I didn't realize that while we were so busy fighting, you know, communism back in Stalin's day, and back in the days of when communism was more out in the open as to what it represented, because there were a lot of defectors coming out from the Soviet Union, and I met some of these defectors, it's communism, communism. Look, it's taken over the world. Look, another country goes to communism. I didn't realize that here in the United States, in the name of fighting communism, we were creating essentially the same thing under another name. We called it anti-communism. And I didn't realize in those days that this business of the right wing and the left wing were really the same. So basically, when we got into World War I, even before that, we started to adapt totalitarian measures at home. We were asking people to give up their liberties because we were at war, and we had to fight totalitarianism overseas. And in the name of fighting totalitarianism overseas, we were becoming totalitarian at home. And I didn't see that. And if somebody had said that to me, I would have said, oh, what are you, a commie or something, you know, like that? A knee-jerk reaction. And but no, then I got to realize, oh my gosh, I had been fooled, or not necessarily fooled, I just didn't see it, that's all. So yeah, we have to be willing to challenge our own beliefs. Not that we're going to change our mind easily, but who knows? Facts are facts. And if you're not willing to look at the facts, you're going to make some terrible mistakes.
Just one more on this term, conspiracy theorist. When was this? Do you know when this actually was coined, and the motive behind that?
I don't really know. I've heard different versions of that, and I've never researched it myself. But I've been told that it was a phrase that was developed in the psychological laboratories at the CIA, or one of the other so-called security agencies. But it was designed. I've heard this. I can't show you the documents, but it sounds logical, that they came up with words that they could use to neutralize their, you know, opposition. And it's name-calling, basically. And if you call people enough nasty names, and if you hear it coming from multiple sources over a long enough period of time, the average person is going to think, you know, where there's smoke, there's fire, or something like that. You know, it must be true because I keep hearing it. And but the short answer is, I don't really know where it was coined, but I suspect it was coined by the enemies of freedom.
Now, moving on, for most of your work, I see that you really make sure that you're quoting the right sources, that you're really academic in your research. So because you don't want to take any shortcuts and just not hearsay. So like when we talk about now this history that you share about the very interesting history, can you take us back to how kind of the story of the beginnings of the medical institution that we have today that you talk about?
Yeah, actually I can. That's one of the areas I did do some serious research on when I was writing my book, World Without Cancer, because you can't really deal effectively with an issue of disease. Why is a disease spreading in a time when we have modern science and when we're spending so much money? And that was a question that came up. Here we are, had the war on cancer, and the United States was spending more money on finding a cure for cancer than all the rest of the nations of the world combined. Man, there were millions and millions and millions of dollars going out for research and studies and so forth, and yet the rate of cancer continued to climb, we got to the point where it was worse in the United States than any place else in the world, in spite of all this money being spent. Now, I should have been smart enough to recognize the wisdom of that old saying, follow the money. You know, the more money that's being spent on something, it should raise your awareness that, well, wait a minute, who's getting the money and how is this going? Are they pretending to have a worthy cause as a cover for the fact that they're just, you know, protecting their own interests or making profit at your expense? Quite often, unfortunately, that is the case. Not always, but all too often. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I got a whiff of all that in the beginning. So I started to write about cancer, and it became obvious that the reason the cost of cancer research and therapy was going up while the results were going down is because there was corruption. Just as I theorized a moment ago, there was a lot of corruption in that industry. And it was unpleasant for me to face because I did not want to think that the whole medical profession was not dedicated to my best interest and my health. I discovered, no, it's not. I'm sorry to tell you, Edward, it's not. Their primary goal, not everybody, not individually, but as an industry, the policymakers at the top, and I'll mention in a moment who those are, they're not interested in you. You don't matter at all to them. They're interested in their own pursuits, their own, in this case, it's their own profit motives. And we're talking about the pharmaceutical industry. And this all came to pass back in 19, starting about turn of the 18th century to the 19th century, 1900s. There was a situation at that time when there was a lot of criticism about the quality of medical care in America. There were people who had licenses, they called themselves doctors, they had their sign out, and they had no degrees, they had no professional training, and there was a lot of, they didn't call it quackery in those days, but that's what we would call it today. People pretending to be doctors who were not doctors. And so there was a lot of criticism about that. Oh, this is terrible. What are we going to do about it? I might add, before I go on, that it's true that there were a lot of very unscrupulous people in the medical profession pretending to have knowledge that they didn't have. But at the same time, most people doing this historical review forget to notice that a lot of those people without degrees were very good doctors because they had learned everything they had that they knew from their grandmother. And their grandmother had learned a lot from her grandmother.
And it was hand-me-down medicine. That does not mean it's bad medicine. In fact, it's very good medicine because it's been tested and tried over generation after generation. So there were a lot of good doctors without official degrees. But nevertheless, that was the condition at the time. And so the Rockefellers, who were heavily invested in the emerging medicine field, the chemical aspect of medicine, not the herbal, not the natural type of medicine, but the test tube medicine. They were heavily invested in this industry because actually they were involved as cartel members with one of the largest, well, probably the largest cartel in the world at that time for sure, called IG Farben, which came out of Germany. It's IG Farben, I believe, stood for Interessengemeinschaft Farbindustrie. I murdered the pronunciation of the German, but it stands for Interessengemeinschaft, I've been told, means a community of interest, which means a cartel in English. It's a cartel, and Farbindustrie means, Farben industry means the dye stuffs industry. It all started out of dyes. The earliest form of chemistry as an industry was to create dyes for clothing and fabrics. From there, it branched into medicines and then, of course, into munitions, how to kill people and then how to heal them after you've blown them up and so forth. Two great industries, by the way, because when you're interested in winning a war, you don't care what it costs. There's no price competition. I don't care about the cost. Give me the weapons. And when you're trying to save your life, it's the same thing. I don't care what it costs. I want the finest guy you can find. I don't care what he charges. I'm trying to save my life or my mother's life. So I've often mused on that fact that they picked two good industries that had very high profit margins and very little price competition. Anyway, I'm taking longer on this than I should. Let me cut to the chase. So the modern pharmaceutical industry came out of IG Farben in Germany. And during... Prior to World War II, in between World War I and World War II, the IG Farben spread around the world and went into partnership with corporations in all countries of the world. And they went into partnership with the Standard Oil of New Jersey, which was the Rockefeller dynasty. And they shared patents and processes. And Germany had no natural source of gasoline. And here was Standard Oil, and they were in the oil business. So there was, each one wanted something that the other person had. The Germans wanted to get more into oil, and Rockefeller wanted to get more into pharmaceuticals, so they cross-pollinated. And all of that was in the background at this time when the public was concerned about the poor quality of education. So now, at this point, Rockefeller funded a small group of researchers. Let's see if I can remember their names. It was a famous report, and I think it was published in 1910 or 1913. Flexner Report. Okay, Flexner. And it was written by Abraham Flexner. Finally, I got the names, came to that. And his brother, Simon Flexner. And now, Abraham was a doctor, but I don't think he practiced medicine. He just had a degree. It was probably one of those phony degrees that we're talking about. And to make a long story short, I've said that twice now. I'll try to do better now. They surveyed the United States, and yeah, they documented that there were a lot of people pretending to have medical knowledge who didn't. Now we have to do something about it. So Rockefeller and his buddy Carnegie put up a lot of money. They proposed reform, medical reform in America. And Congress wasn't willing to spend a lot of money on it. So the idea that Rockefeller and Carnegie, and through foundations, tax-exempt foundations by this time, would grant huge amounts of money to reform education in America was seen as an act of great philanthropy. It was wonderful. What the people didn't realize is that both of them were planning to make a very nice profit out of this because they were going to literally change the orientation of medicine in America. And they did it rather quickly. They went around the country and they found all of, I've forgotten how many, but I'm going to guess there was about six or seven or eight
fairly large institutions that taught medicine in America. And they went to each of them and they said, look, we like what you're doing and we want to give you some money and help you improve your facility. So you can have better buildings, better equipment, you can hire higher quality teachers and so forth. Are you interested? Are you kidding? Are we interested? Of course, they're interested. So when Rockefeller and Carnegie, mostly Rockefeller, would give, let's say, $1 million to some school, boy, they were overjoyed. Now, the next step was they said, since you're receiving this money, we were hoping that you would not mind if you would consider placing on your board of directors someone whom we could recommend so that we could see how our money is being spent and perhaps be aware of the progress that it's being made, so forth. It sounded very legitimate. And so everyone said, oh, sure, well, who do you want? Well, they put a couple of people on. In almost every case, it was the Flexners, the brothers. They got on the board easily. And then they usually slip another one in after another 6 months or a year. And it didn't take long before the institutions, all of these institutions, were in the control of the Rockefellers because they had captured control of their board of directors. And even the ones who were not appointed by the Rockefellers were afraid to speak up against them because all the money was coming from there. Mm. And so if they rocked the boat, all of a sudden their institution would stop getting the money. So in a period of a very few years, the great teaching institutions in America were taken over by the money that was given to them from the Rockefellers. And the next thing is these guys on the board of directors said, now here's what we're going to do with the curricula. And the curricula was going to be changed. None of this herbal medicine stuff. It's all going to be chemistry. Drugs are that's the solution for the future. We will develop this miracle drugs. We will transform the health of America. And we will train the best minds of America to administer these drugs. And that is exactly what happened. It took me too long to say it. I could have said it in a couple of minutes. But the bottom line, to summarize that, with the investment of a few lousy $1 million, which was a lot of money in those days, they were literally able to capture control of the medical teaching centers of America. And they have maintained that control to this day. Most of the money, research money and development money for the universities, the medical universities today, come from these institutions, the tax-exempt foundations, whose owners have a heavy investment interest in the products that they are going to be using. And so the curricula has been changed, and the average doctor today, very smart guy, very well-intentioned person, has no idea he's being programmed to push drugs. And he knows nothing about nutrition. Most doctors will admit that their wives know more about vitamin C than they do. But they know a lot about all the chemotherapy and all of the psychoactive drugs. I mean, they're experts on this. They're geniuses at it. And that's what happened. It's as simple as that. Money purchased the medical industry.
Is this a conspiracy theory or is this verifiable academic facts that people can go research and look up?
That touches on your statement earlier, and thank you for that. You said that you've noted that everything I write about is very well documented. Mm-hmm. And I've known from the beginning that the stuff I'm writing about is uphill. People don't know about it. They don't want to believe it. And they're going to say, oh, come on, that can't be true. And so I've known everything I say, I have to document. And when I say document, I don't mean quote somebody else who has an opinion. I go to the sources themselves. The people I'm criticizing, I go to their books, to their documents, to their records. I get their statements. And most of them talk quite frankly about it. It's amazing. Except they don't count on you and I reading the stuff that they've written. So yes, it is very easy to document this. It's a matter of public record. You find all the documents you need in any well-stocked library. Now, in the days ahead, as we move to digital, I suppose it'll be easier to start removing those things. But as long as they're on books and on the shelf, it's a little more difficult to go in and eliminate a paragraph or rewrite a paragraph in an old book. When it's digital, you can rewrite the Bible and still have the cover on it. It still says the King James Version, but it won't be the same necessarily.
You know? So grandma's old recipe that was passed down from generation to generation, that's out the window. And you mentioned, is that why nutrition is not studied by doctors in medical school?
It's exactly why, yeah. Not only not studied, but it's derived. derived. I mean, derided, I should say. I mean, most people, not just doctors, oh, you're one of those health nuts? Oh, you take vitamins? not for me. I'll take my drugs. That's I'll go to my doctor. I got all these meds, and they're expensive. I wouldn't dream of going to take vitamin C or vitamin D3. I haven't vitamins, you know. That's the way it is.
You mentioned more people are living off cancer than actually dying from it.
That's true. Mm-hmm. Look at the industry. I mean, you've got all of the whole hospital system. I don't know what the ratio is, but I would venture that the largest portion of money that flows into the hospitals and into the doctor's offices, visits, and through the insurance program, surely the greater part of that is because of just one disease, and that's cancer. And that's because that, you know, they're paid $5,000 for a vial of chemotherapy. $5,000 for something that's harmful, it actually destroys your immune system. In the name of hoping to destroy the cancer cells, it'll also destroy other cells too, your good cells. And most doctors will admit, oh yeah, the whole plan of chemotherapy is to kill the cancer just before we kill the patient. It's a sort of nip and tuck thing, you know. And so the patients who undergo chemotherapy, quite often their death certificate may say they died of cancer, but they really died of the chemotherapy, you know. It's an interesting story. That's all I can say. And it's hard, you know. When I was a young guy, I was really finding it very hard to believe that there was this much corruption in high places, in such important things as health, freedom, you know, information, vital to our lives, our well-being, our health, our longevity, our outlook on life, our morality even. I couldn't understand that. And so I'm very sympathetic to people hearing this message for the first time. And I don't mind if you want to call me a conspiracy theorist, that's okay. But go check me out, okay? And see if you still think so after you read my documentation and read the words of the people themselves who are doing this to us. Because in many cases, they describe how they do it, and they boast about how successful it is.
Last couple of questions. Why do you think this history is important for people to know? Some of the...
Well, I sort of touched on it just then, that it's because the two most important things in life are our health and our freedom. If you're free as a bird, but you're sickly and in pain and all crippled over, can't enjoy life, what good is freedom? And if you're healthy, strong as an ox, and you're in a concentration camp as a slave, what good is health, you know? So those two, to me, represent the two legs, the cornerstone, if you will, or the side stones of being a human, of having a purpose in life and enjoying life. Otherwise, your humanity, your life is means nothing. So I think I could probably talk about this issue for a long, long time, but that summarizes it. It's your humanity. It's your it's your being. Your health and your freedom need to be defended at all costs.
And if, again, for someone who wants to get in touch, you're not selling anything. Your stuff is out there. It's pretty much, public record on your website. How can people, again, what's the website where people can look into some more of your work?
Well, as I say, the commercial side, if you want to actually get hold of the books and the videos and all that stuff, is realityzone.com. But to explore the path to all of these things, we just have the ideas and the discussions and the challenges, debates, and that kind of thing going on. The starting point for that is redpilluniversity.org.
And we open up people to reach out to you. You also... You speak on some things. I haven't looked too much into it, but about Noah, we call it Noah. There's something there. Yeah. Yeah.
I produced a documentary some years ago. I got fascinated by the story of Noah's Ark.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know. I have something wrong with my brain, but I'm attracted to things like this. Mysteries.
Yeah.
Mysteries of ancient history.
We can maybe continue on in our next conversation in the future, possibly, but to see kind of, I don't know if you looked into some of the Islamic sources, you know, because Noah, we believe, him as one of the, you know, great messengers that God Almighty sent, you know, Noah, Moses, Abraham, Jesus, peace be upon him, peace be upon them all, and then Muhammad being the last. But this would be a great conversation, you know, because there's a lot of commonalities there, you know, and you would probably be interested to see, you know, from the
Islam. Well, yes, I love that topic. It's still somewhat of a mystery, but I think most of the mystery points have been solved. And the short version is that, yes, there's a relic up on the side of a mountain at 7,000 foot elevation, not way up at 14, not up on Mount Ararat. It's 16 miles away from Mount Ararat, but it's there. You can walk on it. You can measure it. You can see it's the relic. It's the fossilized evidence of a ship. And if you can see that, you know, if it's not Noah's Ark, it's somebody's Ark. And what's it doing up there?
Because we believe in this, you know, in Noah and this story of the you know, the great the flood. Yes,
absolutely. Yeah, well, I have to say on that, I didn't believe in it. It's not that I disbelieved. I said, oh, maybe not. I couldn't say I believe in it. I had no theological reason to accept or reject it. I just, oh, that's an interesting story. Probably not true, you know.
Yeah.
But then when I saw the physical evidence, it was so overpowering. I just had to say, it's somebody's ark. And we don't know whose ark it was, but and that'll always be a question until they dig up a brass plaque that says built by Noah and so.
Yeah. The only thing there we believe was a localized instead of a worldwide. That's just the only difference. It was more localized.
It was localized, but not, it was around the world, but in a narrow band because there was a flood. There was literally a tidal wave that spun around the earth at that median. And it was well, we can go into that at some other time as to what caused the tidal wave, but I'll just let you have a peek at it. It was interaction with, I believe, something from outer space, like Mars moving from one orbit to another, coming very close to Earth. And, you know, gravitational impact on the tides of the ocean are very strong. The moon moves the oceans up and down quite a bit, even 40 feet at the Bay of Fundy. So you can imagine something about the size of Mars being not as close as the moon, but not too much further out. It would have wreaked havoc on the oceans. They would have been pulled out, and they would have swirled around the world. But as you said, not all around the world. It would be, as the Earth is spinning, Mars is up here and the Earth is spinning, well, then you've got this gravitational impact on one area. So that's why there's fossil evidence all around the world in a certain plane, but not outside of that plane. Anyway, that's an interesting story.
Maybe for next time. And if you ever need any information regarding, because that's what we do, we try to clear many of the misconceptions about Islam, educate people, because there's a lot of myths and also misconceptions, and we try to debunk those things and help people have a better understanding. So we'd be a great resource for you if you ever want us to send you anything or any questions. We're here for you.
We're here for you. Thank you. I appreciate that. And I'm interested in all of these things. I feel the thing I hate the most about getting old, the most thing, is that, darn, I don't have enough time to learn everything or even a little piece of something. I don't want to die and not know something more than I do now. You know, mm-hmm. So to me, that's the great worry about death, is that I'm going to miss something.
Yeah. And that's why I mentioned Muslim and Islam. And then just so you know, since you like learning something, Islam just means to acquire peace by submitting yourself to the one and only one God, the same that God that Jesus, Moses, Abraham worship. That's the God we worship, the creator of the heavens and the earth. And a Muslim is one who submits, is the one doing the submitting, the submitter to God. That's all it is. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I appreciate that. So I thank you. And I hope take too long to answer.
I was honored to have you on the program. God bless you. Thank you so much.
All right, Eddie. Thanks for inviting me.
Thank you. Goodbye. Peace be with you. And if you like this episode of The Dean Show, like this video, share this video far and wide, and support us on our Patreon page so we can continue this work. Thank you for tuning in. Peace be with you. Assalamu alaikum.